Welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline Diest, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. Speaking with Kim Newman. Hi, Kim. How are you going?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am very well. I'm very excited to speak with you.
Oh, well, I'm very excited to be spoken to.
You said you're in the bunker, so...
Yeah, I'm towards the end of a project, so I haven't been out of the house much in the last month or so, and I haven't seen the outside world that much, so I may well talk your ear off, because I've essentially shut up for longer than is humanly possible for me.
All right, a little introduction about Kim. So Kim is a critic, writer, journalist, broadcaster, and all-round encyclopedia of film knowledge. He's a regular contributor to Sight and Sound and Empire magazines. He is currently writing a TV series with Mark Kermode on film genre. Mm-hmm. And he has a new novel out later in the year. So thank you so much for speaking with me today. Yeah. Good. Mm-hmm. Good. I'm glad we sorted that out before we started. Yeah. Okay, so how I like to start is a few kind of warm-up questions. So you've been cooped up in the house, so maybe this is like a jog around the block, some kind of toe touches and stuff like that. So you write film criticism, you write short stories, novels, radio plays, all of that, all different types. Mm-hmm. Which one's your favourite?
Oh, it's writing novels. It's the most but that's probably because it's the one which most depends on me. Most other stuff I do is sort of collaborative or, cut to fit the requirements of the editors of magazines or whatever stuff. And I love doing that. I like doing lots of different things. I get something out of all the forms of writing I've done. But I feel that novels are kind of like the purest me there is. And like all writers, I have an enormous sense of my own self-worth. so therefore, writing novels is the thing that lets me express that the most. You know, I don't have to get up and say thank you to loads of other people. Although, in fact, I do, because my editors are particularly important. Kath Treckman at Titan, I've said I didn't particularly want to do a book ever again without her. So, yeah. when people ask I say novelist and critic, if I'm being introduced to thing, and I think that's a reasonable sense of what I am. Mm.
Okay, so your process in writing novels, are you a plotter?
Yeah, right.
Are you a plotter or a pantser?
I'm not particularly a plotter. I usually know what the end is going to be, and I work my way there. My outlines tend to be very loose. Sometimes I've done books which have sort of the structure of murder mysteries, so those obviously have to be quite tightly prearranged to deliver clues and play fair and all that kind of stuff. But more recently I've been doing things which sort of stray a little. Quite often I diverge from outlines in the process of writing. I sort of like every day as I get up to work on something surprising myself or having the space to take detours or put stuff in that comes to mind while working on a particular book.
Mm. So in terms of a lot of your books have a historical setting, does research play into the way that you plot?
Yes, it does. The historical stuff I've done quite often, it's almost the smart way of doing something is to write the book and then research it afterwards. So it's like that means you only find out the stuff you need to know. Mm. It's like you write the book and then you go through and work out when the zip fastener was invented or all those other things. But What I've tended to do is just read around the subject and look at things I want to address. And quite a lot of really good stuff has come up during the process of researching. Sometimes you come across things which are sort of too cool not to use, and I will sort of change tack or direction in the work to use that kind of material. But also, although I've written historical stuff, I don't feel the obligation that some historical novelists feel to, you know, fantastic accuracy and correctness, in that I still write mostly sort of fantastical work. So I feel a certain leeway is allowed.
Absolutely. So, and when you're writing, do you have a writing fuel of choice?
But not in any particularly useful way. It's mostly coffee and biscuits, but I think that's not exactly unusual. And even then, I mean, I work from home, obviously, so most people who do that have a cupboard in the kitchen full of various types of teas and coffees and drinks, just because, every couple of hours you want to get up and do something, and making a cup of something is gives you a pause for thought or whatever.
Any particular favourite biscuit?
No, not really. something with chocolate on, you know. And in fact, I'm not a particular vast consumer of biscuits, or even I don't even drink that much coffee. But I tend to start. I go out first thing in the morning and get a cup of takeout coffee from a local cafe, just so I can make sure that I've seen the sky. So I don't just get up and sit at the desk and work in my dressing gown, which frankly most writers can do. But I like a little sense of I suppose the sort of ritual of beginning work. And even then, there are others of delaying things that come between that and actually starting or opening the file.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay, so it sounds like we've got to know you a little bit more. You're not always in the dressing gown.
Yeah, no.
So I'd like to get a bit more in depth now. So, how do you describe your writing, and what themes do you like to explore?
The thing is, I've got this problem of spending quite a bit of my time being a critic. So I spend a lot of time describing other people's work. It's almost like I sometimes feel that what I do as a critic is put other people's work in boxes. And what I do as a writer is try not to be put in a box. Obviously, I've written in various genres. You can usually find me in the horror section of bookshops, if bookshops have a horror section. Although I think that doesn't quite fit. I've written horror novels and I've written ghost stories. But quite a lot of what I've written is closer to satire. I've written some science fiction, I've written crime, and I've written sort of historical novels. And I see thematic connections between them, and even structural connections and things. And there are all kinds of threads that tie all my work together. But I like to write in different moods. The novel that's out at the moment, Anno Dracula 1000 Monsters, which is part of a series, is kind of... I suppose adult oriented. It's got lots of violence and weird monsters and strangers. But the book I'm working on now, which is also part of a series, is it's not quite a young adult novel, but it's about a school. And so I've had to sort of write basically about children, about kids, and I think, obviously, you don't want to chop lots of heads off in a book like that, or have lots of swearing or all these kind of things. So I feel I'm on slightly better behavior with this book than on the last one. And the next one I'm going back to, it's another Anno Dracula book, and that'll be wilder and crazier and more horrific. But yeah, no, I don't think of myself as a particular type of writer. I think of myself as me. Mm-hmm. I suppose every writer likes to think that. And I am very aware of the exigencies of marketing and sort of, yeah, building a relationship with an audience. I do find that I know people who have this, other writers who are sort of known for one type of thing, and sometimes get fed up that people only remember, say, one of their books, even though they've been writing for years and years and years. But I've got this weird thing where when people come up and talk to me, there are maybe five or six different things I have done over the years that people particularly remember. There are different strands to my work, and different strands appeal to different people. Some I've even met people who didn't even realize that I was one person. Yeah. People who didn't know that the film critic Kim Newman and the novelist Kim Newman were the same guy. So it is possible to do that. Although to me, it's obvious that it's all the same stuff.
Mm. Good. All right. So let's talk about the writing process itself.
Yeah.
So what do you think has been the one thing that's been most helpful in improving your writing?
I'm not sure it has improved that much. Probably reading. Yeah, but that's a really boring answer. I mean, I've had I'm not, you know, self-taught. I went to university and I studied English and I read lots and lots of different books. Writing is something you do, yeah, mostly on your own, although I've actually collaborated on fiction as well. So I have done the stand in a room and throw ideas around, which is a healthy process. But it has mostly been, just me sat here typing. Yeah, that's it.
Reading.
Reading. Yeah, that's it. I mean, there are sort of broader things that I've been fortunate in. One thing that didn't seem fortunate at the time, but is in retrospect, is never having had a real job. So I have had, yeah, time to work that many people who become writers now don't have. I have supported myself as a writer these many years now, and quite a lot of the things I did when I was starting out are not available to newer or younger writers now, so I tend not to talk about them much because it rubs in how things have changed since. I mean, I graduated in 1980. Since then, there are many, many things that make choosing writing as a career less of a good idea than it was then.
Mm-hmm. So I know you said you didn't want to talk about it because it rubs it in, but what kind of things did you start off in your career to make that trajectory happen?
Oh, well, no, back then it was possible to get work on a magazine by sending some samples in. Mm-hmm. And yeah, people. Yeah, I worked for various. I reviewed films for London listings magazines and the NME, and actually a thing called the Monthly Film Bulletin, which is now part of Sight and Sound, which I'm still working on. But it was possible for someone in their early 20s to, write some sample pieces. I think I had a couple of pages torn out of fanzines and university things, put them in an envelope and send them to the commissioning editors of the film departments of magazines and get a reply. Now, the way in tends to be through internships. Mm-hmm. And actually what it is, magazines don't want contributors. They want people to work in the office who will also contribute. I've never done that. I've never worked in the office. I've always been a freelance. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that I moved to London. I found somewhere really cheap and horrible to live. and I was on supplementary benefits. I didn't have a student loan to pay off because I had a student grant. So I graduated in debt to the tune of £30, which I paid off with my first benefit check. Yeah. So all these things, which didn't seem particularly like advantages then, but now seem arcaded. I know people who are the contributing, the reviews editors of all these magazines now. They don't have time to read stuff that comes in, and they are bombarded by graduates trying to get any kind of work. And basically, there aren't the slots anymore. It's a shrinking market in print. The thing is, now you can put all this stuff, you can have your own website and you can post as much stuff as you like, but you won't make any money off it. There's no way of supporting yourself through that. Whereas for me, and there are other things. I mean, I wrote humorous articles for porn magazines with Eugene Byrne and Neil Gaiman, and that I bought my first computer out of doing those, and that kind of stuff. I doubt if and that was something a bunch of other sort of writers of my vintage did for a while, and I don't think that's open anymore as a market. I haven't seen a porn magazine since the 80s. I know they still sort of exist, but that's kind of like, again, thank you, Internet, for providing so much sort of free stuff that people who used to earn a living at it are gone. But that was there. I did various other bits of odd writing. I wrote, they didn't come out in the, my first book, Nightmare Movies, is which is still around and updated, is sort of got a bit of attraction. I was fortunate to be one of the first people to write about contemporary horror films, and that got a bit of attention. But the initial publisher of that, who were actually a sort of fly-by-night concern who went bankrupt the week after publishing my book, they hired me to write a bunch of other, illustrated film books. I wrote a book about Marilyn Monroe, and a couple of other movie star type books that never got published. I wrote a book about Steven Spielberg when it would have been like one of the first books about him, and that never came out. But although I didn't get paid much for those, it was enough for me to what we call in Britain sign off. That means no longer take supplementary benefits. And in fact, I lived for 2.5 years essentially on benefits. And now kids have to stay at home because they can't get the money to to rent even a really dodgy place. And there is no such thing as what I had was it's now called Job Seekers Allowance, but then it was supplementary benefit. And basically they left you alone. Every time I had to deal with the bureaucracy of it, I would go in and I'd show them some cuttings from the magazines I'd been working for and doing bits for, and they were sort of happy because they looked and saw, here is somebody who has sort of a game plan and is genuinely doing some work. Now, people in my position aren't left in peace to do that. If you want any kind of state benefit, you basically have to do a full-time job of applying for a kind of employment that doesn't exist anymore. The bureaucracy, and it was bad then, actually. I've got to say, it's not sort of some kind of halcyon day. This was like early Thatcherism. Mm. So it was a fairly grim time in Britain. But there were opportunities. And I look around at my sort of peers and friends, people who started out at the same time, and most of us are still around because we had that grounding in it. Whereas people who came along 10, 15 years afterwards had and continue to have a much greater struggle just to make a living, let alone make a career.
Mm. And do you think also of that era you had the opportunity to work with editors or mentors or whatever to help you improve along that way?
I suppose so. I mean, I felt that the editors I worked for then tended to be open to new people. What it was is that editors, on all kinds of editors, book editors, magazine editors, commissioning editors, just had more time to deal with new contributors, new writers. I remember not an editor, but a publicist at one of the publishers saying that it's a mistake to think of our product as books. Our product is writers. Mm. And there was a sense that the writers would be signed up and developed. And I had that. My first two or three novels were sort of shepherded through. Yeah, I wrote a science fiction novel, a couple of horror novels, and then Anno Dracula, which is sort of lots of different types of novels in one. And I had a sense that my oeuvre was allowed to build. I was given space to do stuff which was not hugely successful at first, with a sense that at least I was gaining a readership and gaining a career. And that has, with a few interruptions, it's not all been smooth sailing, has continued ever since, that I've been lucky to have relationships with people who wanted not just one book that would make a lot of money, but wanted a succession of books. Now the book publishing industry doesn't really work like that. And actually, it's even more extreme in the film industry. Everybody says it's much easier to get your first film made than it is to get your second.
Mm. Okay. Well, that sounds like a bit of a downer for a...
sorry about that.
Like me.
But also, the other thing is that I'm not really qualified to talk about all the... how to get started now, because I am not getting started now. I got started then. and I do think that there are now different routes to being a writer than there were then. What I'm not sure about is whether there are different routes to being a professional writer, being self-supporting as a writer. I think more and more, writers now seem to have other jobs.
Mm.
And obviously there are some things that go really well with writing. Being an academic, for instance, you're required to write a lot anyway. And most universities or colleges like the idea that their teachers are published. Mm. And that's a draw. But there are plenty of people, I know a British writer who spent quite a long time after his first novel was published still being a bus driver because he liked it. Magnus Mills, really interesting. Actually, fallen a bit silent lately, but and they made a bit of a fuss about that. And I sort of talked to him about it, and he didn't think that there was anything unusual about being a bus driver and a writer. Different shifts. He had time to work, and he got out and he saw people and all this sort of stuff, which is good. But the world of work says that. And I also have the advantage of not having children, which I know is one of an enormous time drain. And the way writers' houses are arranged, you have to sort of, and another advantage I had as a starting out is my parents are also freelance. My dad's retired now, and my mum's passed away, but they were potters, and so they kind of didn't give me the hassle about getting a proper job that many other writers I know had. They sort of understood how that worked, but also that that gave me a certain space to find my own way without having to worry about other things.
Okay, so you've talked about a few writers there. You've dropped a few names here and there. So what writers inspire you?
Probably my favourite writer is Raymond Chandler, who's somebody I go back to. I think just as sort of nuts and bolts, right? And there are a couple of other sort of... I hesitate to call Raymond Chandler an American writer, although he is technically American, but he's also sort of British. But there are other writers. I mean, I like Cornell Woolrich and Dashiell Hammett, Stanley Ellin, someone I like, Glendon Swarthout, Patrick Hamilton, all these sort of mid-century, slightly shabby, depressed sort of crime writers. My first book was about film noir, and I think the kind of writers who inspired those films. And cinema is really important to me as well. So obviously, I think I'm probably as inspired by filmmakers as writers. In my chosen genres, classic writers, Arthur Conan Doyle, Edgar Allan Poe, Bram Stoker, Robert Louis Stevenson, and contemporary writers like Ramsey Campbell, Peter Straub. But I'm reasonably well read in what's going on. I admit that I have fallen around. My to-be-read pile is now much taller than it used to be. And there are plenty of other things that I am interested in. And there are lots of – I'm also quite inspired by people who write nonfiction. So I keep track of a lot of those things as well.
Is there any film critics as well?
David Thompson, Cynthia Rose, Judith Williamson, Anne Bilson, some of the people who've been writing. David J. Scow recently, I think, writes really interestingly about films that I'd sort of forgotten. I sort of end up doing this weird thing of peering by bookshelves. Grail Marcus, who writes about music, I find really interesting and stimulating. All these are people, of course, that I have huge arguments with, but that's sort of part of the job. Being a critic is it requires you to be kind of opinionated and judgmental, but also there's that weird thing that sometimes you write a long piece about something and then somebody asks, but did you like it? Which is always kind of annoying to me as a question. It's like the point isn't whether I like it, it's whether you like it. My critical range is not really good and bad, but interesting and dull. And there are some things I find interesting that maybe aren't amazingly good, but are interesting. There are some things that are perfectly acceptable that I find dull and have no particular interest in writing about.
So how do you? So imagine you're writing to deadline for some of these film reviews.
All sort of. magazine stuff is done to quite tight deadlines. And one of the reasons that I have lasted so long is I'm quite good at that. I know that when I started out, I thought that I probably couldn't be the best at what I was doing, so I'd be the fastest. And as a sort of freelancer, it's a good discipline because it's something to do with the way that the film industry has changed since the 80s as well. It used to be that a film was finished and shown to the press maybe months before it actually opened. And so, yeah, they would have a screening and you'd go to it and you would probably have, you know, a couple of weeks to think about your piece before you wrote it. Now, increasingly, films don't exist until 2 days before they open. And people have to see them, digest them, and turn something around overnight, which is a particular skill. And sometimes it's why quite a lot of the film criticism that comes out of the Cannes Film Festival or other film festivals is sort of negligible because it's written by people who've seen 25 films and been up all night and aren't and are subject to bizarre instances of groupthink. But as I say, I early on decided that I would just be the guy who got the copy in the next day. And that has served me well ever since. There are still people who sometimes hire me to cover things because they know that if they ask, I will get it done. I'm always amazed at the number of people who are freelance writers who aren't particularly reliable, because that's sort of, you know, this, I know that when somebody is sitting there in an office saying, who should we get to do this? The guy who delivers will always be bumped up ahead of the person who, you know, maybe gives you a great piece, but it comes so late you can't use it. Or it means that someone has to stay up all night in order to get it into the magazine. Those sort of things. And, you know, there's a challenge about delivering. And I always feel that you accept a deadline. It's your word. People always quote Douglas Adams about deadlines. And the trouble with that is the Douglas Adams is somebody who was suffered crippling writer's block that probably ruined his life and was very, very unhappy about his inability to deliver. And he made two or three funny jokes about it, which get quoted. It's almost, you do realize how much damage he did to himself. I mean, he did to himself by sheer worry about all this stuff, and how much damage he did to the people who work with him as well, who found him increasingly difficult, almost impossible, simply because the stuff never turned up. So yeah, it is it's a survival mechanism to learn to meet a deadline.
And does that discipline carry over to your novels?
I say that when, in fact, I'm slightly late delivering the one I'm on now. But yeah, usually I always try to take into account the fact that a publisher has got a schedule and wants this thing. I mean, the thing is, of course, in 20 years' time, nobody cares that your book came out on time. But so the job is still to make it the best book it can possibly be. But then again, there is that sort of, if it was up to me, I would probably never let the thing off my desk. I could happily spend years every day opening the file, going through, taking out commas, changing that to which, and then back again, and all this slight refinements and improvements and corrections. And sometimes if you do that too much, you can just kill the piece. But so it is useful to have someone screaming to take the thing away from you.
Do you want to talk about what you're writing right now?
I'm happy to. In that I basically finished the draft yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's a bank holiday weekend in Britain. So I'm going to today and tomorrow I'm not doing particularly much on the book, but over the weekend I'm doing the final read through, spell check, and just sort of look through, see if there are any particular concerns that need to be addressed before it goes to the editor. So it's essentially finished, but I'm about to spruce it up in that sort of minute thing that I like to do at the end, at least just to get it all back in my head. Mm. One of the things about being a novelist that very rarely comes up in sort of discussions of how to write novels or is that you write a book over a set number. I've been writing this book for 5 months. People will read it over 5 days, or sometimes people read it in a single day. So they will have in their head what the color of the character's eyes are.
Mm.
Whereas you may have mentioned it once 4 months ago.
Mm.
It's very easy to make mistakes, to get things wrong, to have inconsistencies creep in, because you have spent longer on it than a reader will spend. And usually, I have very good line editors and copy editors and people who will pick up on stuff like that. That said, in the course of writing this book, I found out that there's an actual continuity glitch in the book that it's a follow-up to, and there's nothing I can do about it. It's too late sort. So things creep through, and no, I'm not going to say what it is.
So you need a continuity person there, just making sure that everything.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, Titan are very good at that, because my books, or some of my books, are quite complicated. They have lots of characters and lots of sort of tiny things going on in the background that sort of fit together. They are quite good. And for instance, a couple of years ago, I wrote this book called Angels of Music, which is sort of a spin on the Phantom of the Opera, and it's set in 19th and early 20th century Paris. They had somebody go through it, a French reader go through it and pick up on the few bits of French that I'd put in, but also just some sort of detailed stuff, somebody who actually knew the place better than I did. Mm. And that is that kind of extra help is useful. I had my Japanese editor go through 1,000 Monsters, which is set in Japan. And again, I had some very useful tiny pointers. And quite often it's sort of it's in the 1% of improvements, yeah, you can do it. It's those little things nobody will ever complain about, but it's nice to get them sorted out.
Mm-mm. Beautiful. So just putting a little bow around it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So that's what I'm going to be doing this weekend while everybody else is having a nice holiday.
Oh, you didn't get a holiday for the wedding. I thought maybe that was...
No, I'm a freelance writer. We don't get bank holidays. I worked through the royal wedding. I mean, in fact, I don't think they don't give they don't give school kids holidays for... royal weddings. It was on Saturday, wasn't it, as well?
Yeah.
So that they wouldn't have. And in fact, all other things that, yeah, yeah. When I say bank holiday weekend, it's like, you know, writers sigh at the thought of that. You know, and I get the, and actually not just writers as well. I see a political candidate in Britain recently announced that one of his platforms was adding an extra bank holiday to the year. And I looked and thought, he's got this 1950s idea of what work is.
Yeah.
And I would like the figures on how many people actually work like that now.
Mm.
Because I know most people I know don't.
And I mean, when I get a public holiday, it's more like because I have a day job and I write on the side. It's like, woohoo, a day to write.
Yeah. Yeah. But with me, it's quite often I just get up and wonder why it's so quiet.
All right. Well, I've taken up a lot of your time.
Well, that's quite right. I hope this is all useful for you.
It's gone all over the place. Lots of different places I wasn't expecting.
Oh, well.
It's been great. So if people want to find out more about you and your work, where's the best place to find you online?
Oh, it's my website, which is www.johnnyalucard.com. If you just Google Kim Newman, is the first thing that comes up. So it's got all my sort of links to what's available now and bibliography. Also, I actually put quite a bit of film criticism stuff up there as well. So it is my own little window. I'm not arrogant enough to have a blog, but I do. I try and put content up there that is available to people as well. And I try and keep the list of all the things I do and have done updated. And you can follow me on Twitter and get amusing, hopefully, film quotes every morning or most mornings.
From very obscure films. It's not like...
Yeah, although sometimes I put in stuff from famous films as well, but because people... So they seem to forget mostly it's the odder things that I cover. I mean, I've not yet finished the big file of quotes I've got lying here. There's a lot more cool stuff.
So you do get there every morning, sit there and find one and type
not
it in.
Every morning. It's but most mornings. It's obviously, if I'm away from my desk or whatever or traveling, I don't. Sometimes I forget, but most ways it's part of the ritual I do of when I turn the computer on, check my email, all this stuff, say happy birthday to people on Facebook, and then I just add the quotes then. So it's usually. Sort of about 9 o'clock British time is when they get posted. But I try and do it most days.
Oh, I love them. Especially, they're just usually very bizarre and it's like films I've never ever heard of most of the time.
Yes. Well, that's part of the point, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kim.
Well, thank you. And send me a link or whatever, and I'll do my best to plug.
Yes, okay, fantastic. Thanks a lot, Kim.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Right Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter. No apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Write Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?